30 minutes. Here we go. Let's get right into it. My name is Paul. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Mark for the invitation to come up here. Cameron for bringing me up. It was very nice of him to do. It is only by God's grace, strong sponsorship, and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that I've been able to stay sober since June 3rd of 1985. It is my first sobriety date, and I am thankful for that. I'm thankful to see another one of my classmates. Daryl is here, class of 85, and I have two more days than Daryl, and we go to the same home group in Bellflower, and every Monday night when we see each other, Daryl comes up and he asks me if I want a cup of coffee, and he knows that. He does that because he knows I don't drink coffee, so he doesn't know he doesn't have to do anything. He can just he can get the credit for doing nothing. What I was like before I had my first drink of alcohol was that I was a scared, self-centered, self-obsessed kind of a kid. I didn't know that. I didn't have any of those kind of thoughts or feelings when I was growing up. It wasn't until my first drunk that once I had the effect of alcohol in me that I realized how scared I was and how afraid I was and how different I had felt. My first drunk was at a party, house party, a bunch of people going around and standing around at a rich kid's house over in Westlake Village where I grew up. I grew up in Agora, out in the Thousand Oaks area, and I went there and I was uncomfortable like I had always been, and a guy came up to me at the party and he handed me a solo, red solo cup of something, and I took it. I'd grown up with an alcoholic mom, and I saw what drinking did in my family. I saw what it did, to my brothers. I saw what it did in my house, and I never thought about, not taking the drink or taking it. It never really occurred to me. But when that guy handed me the cup, I wanted to fit in. I didn't want to stand out, and so I just stood there with it for a while, and then everybody else looked like they were having a good time, and so I just started sipping on the drink, and I drank it, and nothing happened to me. I remember it tasted pretty good. It was like a Long Island iced tea kind of a thing, and about 20 minutes later, that guy came by again. He filled up my cup, and I drank that, and that was when the effect of alcohol started to hit me. All of a sudden, I started to realize that I could take a deep breath, that I could kind of just relax a little bit, and I could maybe smile, and I could started to walk through, and I could say hi to some people and things like that, and that was completely not me. I was not that kind of person at all, where I could walk into a group of people and say hi and be comfortable at all. And instead of waiting for that guy to come back around and fill up my cup, I started chasing that guy around the party and having him fill it back up. And what happened to me that night was pretty much what happened to me every time I drank, is that I knew I would be drunk. I kept drinking that night. I got drunk. I knew I was drunk. I remember saying to myself, I'm drunk. I don't need to drink anymore. And I continued to drink well beyond being drunk. I passed out on the stairs. I ended up getting sick, sliding out through the front door, making it into the grass, and throwing up everywhere. Next thing I know, my buddies are picking me up and they drop me off on my neighbor's front lawn, and I come to the next morning with the sprinklers coming on, and that was my first drunk. And I thought, I didn't think, gosh, I'll never do that again. I never had any of those thoughts. I just knew that I was really sick. My dad came in and handed me a trash can and a towel. He said, here you go, sport. And then my buddies called and they said, hey, we're going out. We got another party to go to. Do you want to go? And I said, sure. And I went to that party, and I knew that what I drank the night before was what was the problem. And so I immediately drank, I don't know what I drank, but it was beer or whatever. But the exact same thing happened to me. I continued to drink until I got drunk. I knew I was drunk. I said to myself, I'm drunk. I'm not going to do like I did last night. And the exact same thing happened to me. I continued to drink well beyond being drunk, and then ended up passing out, ended up getting sick, and, you know, same thing all over again. And I was, I don't know, 15 years old when that happened, and I ended up, drinking like that. I thought everybody drank like that. You know, all the people I hung around with in high school all seemed to drink like that, and I didn't think it was that big a deal. I ended up going to the hospital a couple times for alcohol poisoning. I wrecked a couple cars behind drinking and driving, and, you know, we always drank and drive. That was just what I did all the time, and I didn't think anything of it. I ended up, I was an athlete in school. I ended up getting some scholarship offers to go to school, and they take you on these recruiting trips where you go, and they, you know, they try to kind of coerce you into going to their school and that. And so I was going on a couple trips, went to San Diego State and Stanford and Cal, and I went to this one Mormon university up in Utah. I'm not Mormon. I didn't know anything about the Mormons. I had no idea, but it was a free trip and a dinner and the whole thing. So I went, and I got up there, and it was a beautiful spring day. I mean, it was beautiful, and it was the middle of, you know, nice sunny day, and they were ready to give me a full scholarship to go play there, and I was ready to sign, and coach kind of came up to me, and he goes, we have a code of conduct here at the school, religious school, and he handed me this code of conduct, and this code of conduct had all these things on it. You know, you're not going to drink, you're not going to lie, you're not going to steal, you're not going to do drugs, you're not going to cheat, lie, you know, all this stuff. And then at the very bottom, the very last thing was that, is if you see someone doing these things, you're supposed to report them to the authorities so that for their spiritual growth, that they're, you know, whatever. And so I read that, and I was like, and I was thinking to myself, well, I'm not really Mormon. I'm an athlete. It really doesn't apply to me. And so I signed that letter and signed the letter of intent, signed the code of conduct, and went home and continued to drink all summer long, and got in a bunch more trouble that summer. Got on an airplane in the fall going back to school, and I met a girl on the plane, and we kind of hit it off, you know, across the aisle and started talking, and then we met over at baggage claim. And over at baggage claim, we decided we were going to go up to Park City, and we went up to the Black Pearl Cowboy Bar in Park City there, and we got drunk and we got stoned and we slept together, and I basically did everything on that sheet that I just said that I wasn't going to do. And I wasn't on the ground, I don't know, 12 hours maybe at the most. I grew up in Agora, right off of Canaan Road. And right off of Canaan Road, there was a drive-up right where I went to high school. There was a drive-up liquor store there. And I used to just, we would go there, and that's, it was easy to get. There was never a problem getting anything to drink when I was in high school. And I thought it would be like that in Utah. It's not. Just in case you want to know or you haven't been there, they have these state package stores where they're only open certain hours, and the whole thing. And so it was weird to have to go in, and they don't have bars. They have social clubs where you can go into the play. You go into the social club, you sign up for a membership. You go in there, you buy a setup. If you wanted a rum and coke or something, you buy the coke. And then you go next door to the package store, you buy whatever it is, and you bring it in and you pour it yourself, so that's how they get around it. They don't think that's drinking, I guess. But so that's what we started to do. And apparently that guy at the one package store that we used to go to, he read that last line on that code of conduct, because every time I went in there, school found out about it. And they had this nice little file going on me, and I started getting in more trouble, and they were ready to kick me out. And so we started going to Park City. We started going to Salt Lake. We started going out Wendover, Nevada. There was a cool little casino out there that we would go out I-80. And that was kind of where I found the magic elixir for me. I went in there one day and went to the package store to get what I was going to get. And they had these really cool Alaskan Fifth bottles of Everclear. And I'd never, in California, I'd never seen Everclear down here, but we might have it, I guess. But I bought, that's what I drank until I got sober, because you don't need to drink a lot of it, but it'll get you right where I needed to go. And the problem with Everclear is that when you go to class the next day, you look like and you smell like and, you know, you, it looks like you're drunk still. And so I got in more trouble and kind of just drinking my college career away and not really doing much, cheating my way through school and getting in a lot more trouble. And finally, my end of my junior year, we had been making forging federal documents and different things and a little insurance fraud thing that we had going. And the Somalis don't have anything on me, actually. kind of knew how to do that back then. Anyway, they found out about it, and they took away my scholarship. And I'm the kind of guy who my life is run on resentment. You know, to this day, I run on resentment. That seems to be the power and the motivation for a lot of things that I do. That if I'm, you know, I was so resentful that they took away my scholarship that I was just like, you know what? And I'm going to show you. I'm going to show you that you shouldn't have done that. And so my senior year, you know, I'm trying not to get in trouble. I'm not drinking as much and trying to control it, trying to keep it together. And I end up at the end of my senior year, I was a first team All-America. I was a top five player in the country. And at the end of the season came around and we were all going to go turn pro and make our mark in the world and make all kinds of money. And I just told the guys that my life had sucked down to just so small that I just told the guys, I'm not going, I'm not doing it. And I quit and I never played again, actually. And, I went home and did what all champs do. I went home and started living with my mom. And now she's drinking and I'm drinking. A girl that thought that we were in a relationship when I was in Utah, she decides that we're still in a relationship and she moves down with us. And it turns into this big mess. And I deal with a lot of my problems the way my brother did, is that I ignore them and I hope they go away. And I was trying to ignore this girl, and I was hoping that she would go away. And what that did was that she thought we were having relationship problems, and so we should go see a counselor. And so instead of me saying, no, I'm really not interested, I tell her, well, sure, let's go. We'll go to counselor. And so we went to counseling, and I'm still drinking, and it's just a mess. And I go to this lady, very well-meaning lady, very well-meaning lady. And I go there, and she finds out my mom's alcoholic, and she says, oh, well, that's why you drink the way you drink, and that's why you have all the problems you have, and that's why you have these relationship issues, is, you know, because of your mom. And when I hear that, what that does for me is it makes me not responsible for my life. Now I'm a victim. Now I can just blame it on my mom. It's all my mom's fault. You know, and it's really not my fault. And so we continue to go to this lady for a while. And one day she asked me, she goes, you know, you might want to go to an AA meeting and see what it's like for your mom. Just, you know, maybe you hear something there, you know. I'm college educated, but I'm not that bright. And I didn't realize that she understood where I, you know, how much I was drinking, and she was trying to get me to go to this AA meeting. But I went to this meeting. It was a noon meeting at this place in Thousand Oaks, and a bunch of guys my age sitting around at tables, and they were just sitting there, and they were complaining about, you know, they're all, you know, those guys that you see in every meeting, especially in the Alano clubs, that are just happy to be sober, you know, right? They're just gritting their teeth and they're just hanging on, and there's, you know, there's fingernail marks in the chairs, and they're all like that, and they're just talking about losing their wife and their kid and their job and all this. And I'm 23 years old. I don't even have that stuff, so no chance, you know. I didn't lose any of that, you know, and I'm just sitting there listening. And finally, at the end of the meeting, the guy goes, you know, hey, you're new. I've never seen you here before. You know, do you want to say anything? And I remember standing up and just saying, yeah, I'm just really glad I'm not like you people. And they all laughed just like that. And then they said, keep coming back. Right? Again, I'm not real bright. Didn't figure it out. So I came back. And when I came back, I kept hearing the same thing. And I eventually I eventually went to a different meeting where I had moved to, and I got the time of the meeting wrong, and I got there early because I'm used to getting there. You know, if the meeting's at 7:30, I'm there at 7:31, and if it ends at 8:30, I'm out of there at 8:25. And but I got the time wrong, and I go in there, and there's a guy named Eddie D who's still sober today. And he was there, and he was setting up the chairs, and he was making coffee, and I just started talking to him, and he was in the middle of his I don't know if it was that day or that week that his son had just been put in prison for murder, and he just sat there with me, and he started to talk, and he just, you know, and he asked me probably the most important question in Alcoholics Anonymous. He says, "Are you alcoholic?" I said, "I don't know what that means." And he handed me the book, and he says, "Go home and read the doctor's opinion, and if you can identify with something in the doctor's opinion," he goes, "we have another meeting here tomorrow. I'll give you the correct time. We have another meeting tomorrow. Come and see me." And I took that book home, and I read the doctor's opinion, and when it got to the part in the book, in the doctor's opinion, where it talked about the phenomenon of craving, I had words to go with the feelings that I had before, is that I knew I was drunk and I continued to drink well beyond being drunk. Now I had words, and I went back to him that next day, Thursday, and I said, "Eddie, if that's an alcoholic, I am one." And we never talked about him being my sponsor. We never talked about him, about me getting commitments. We never talked about any of that stuff. What I knew was that Eddie was going to be there early, and he was going to be setting up the chairs, and he was going to be making the coffee and doing the ashtrays, and I wanted to talk to Eddie. And so I got there early, and I would say, "Okay, Eddie, what do I do now?" And he was, "Oh, well, put some chairs over there and go get the coffee cups." And so we would just set the thing up, and then I would sit and talk with Eddie, and then sometimes we would read out of the book, and we would just talk. And then after the meeting, we'd get the ashtrays and we'd clean them out and we'd dump the coffee, and then we'd sit and we'd read some more or we'd talk some more. And when I got to parts of the book that I didn't understand that I read at that night or something, you know, I would come to Eddie and I'd say, "Hey, what is this part? What does this mean? Or what is that?" And he would just say, "Oh, when I got to that part, this is what I did." He just taught me through what his experience was or what he did. He never told me what to do. He just said, "This is what I did," you know, and so we kept going along, and I did, you know, four or five meetings for years and years, and that laugh, my last drunk was like I said, in June of 1985, the Lakers were in the NBA playoffs against the Celtics, and I went to my best friend's wedding, and went to the reception, and again, I got sick, sloppy drunk. Went into the bar afterwards to watch a Laker game. Ended up passing out in the bathroom, you know, coming to the next day. I didn't know it was the next day. The janitor came in. He's trying to clean the bathroom. And he goes, "Buddy, what are you doing here?" I go, "I'm with the wedding." He goes, "It's like 9 o'clock the next day. You got to go." And that was my last drunk. And like I said, then I ended up running into Eddie at that meeting. And like I said, four or five meetings a week for 8-9 years, and went back and, you know, and did a fourth step with him, did a fifth step with him, and did went back and made amends. My dad at that time had Alzheimer's, and he hadn't been able to recognize me for probably 3 or 4 years. And in my amends to my dad, I would go back to him, and I would sit and I'd actually lay on the bed with him, and I would have to introduce myself, "Hi, you know, I'm your son, Paul," and I would just start to talk to him about what had started to happen to me, and, you know, started to have a spiritual experience as the result of taking the steps, you know, as a result of doing the work and going back and paying people back the money I owed and all the cheating and lying and stealing and all that stuff that I did. I started to, you know, to have that spiritual experience, and I would go and I'd talk to my dad about it, and I told my dad one day, I said, "Dad," I said, "I hope one day that your body is restored and your mind is restored, and we'll be able to have a father-son conversation." Because my dad was an older guy, and I was young and full of pride, and was embarrassed of my dad. You know, I didn't want my dad hanging around, but I was trying to make amends best I could to him. And he had grabbed my hand that day, and he pulled me in. And he looked at me like he had heard every word I had said that day, And my dad ended up dying that next week. And one of my best friends in AA just passed last week, and Cameron and I, we went to the funeral, and he was a military guy too. And you know, they played taps and shot the guns and did the whole thing. And I just remember sitting there thinking to myself how fortunate I am that I was clean with my dad when he died. You know, I'm not a guy that does very well with having stuff hanging over my head. It drives me crazy. And not too long after that, my the guy Eddie, he got a job transfer, and he moved from Moore Park, where we were living, and going to meetings. So he went to Ventura, and I didn't realize that my phone would work from Moore Park to Ventura, and so I kind of stopped calling Eddie, and I certainly wasn't going to drive from Moore Park to Ventura to go to a meeting, and so I just started, you know, little by little, just, you know, slacking off and stopped going to meetings. And probably in that 6 to 9 months to a year time, I probably went to maybe 5 meetings in that time. And I know what happens when I don't go to meetings. I start to feel that way. I start to get restless. I start to get irritable, discontented. And it started to happen, and it started to happen fast. And I know what the solution to that problem is. And the solution for me is that I should get married. Yep. I married a bartender. Believe it or not. She came to me after 6 months of being married, and she goes, "I'm not sure what's wrong with you, but something's really wrong with you, and I want a divorce." And so now I'm not talking to Eddie, I'm not reading the book, I'm not going to meetings, and what happens to me is that my higher power wants a divorce, and I don't know what to do. And this lady handed me a book on death and dying. She goes, "Going through a divorce is like having a death in the family." And I said, "Okay." And I read this book, and this book was about a lady who had sat with terminally ill people when they died. And her thought was that your soul was like a butterfly, and it would fly off, and your body was like a cocoon, and it would stay behind. And I got sober in 1985. Daryl knows this. I mean, there was stuff going around Alcoholics Anonymous that had nothing to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, there's writing with your left hand and talking to your inner child and carrying teddy bears to meetings and all that stuff. Great. It's not a cure for alcoholism. Doesn't help with alcoholism. All it did for me was get me thinking more about myself, which led me to trying to kill myself for the next 6 months. And so I had put the book down and didn't think much more of it. And my brother from San Francisco called, and he said, "Hey, I'm coming down on business. Can you go see Mom and ask if I can stay there and we can have dinner or something?" I said, "Sure." And same house that I grew up in, and went over there. And I walked in the door, and it was dark, and it was, kind of the middle of the day, and my dog was running around, and I kind of walked through the living room, and I walk in, and I see my mom laying on the floor, and she's half naked and curled up in the fetal position, and there's bottles and defecation all around her, and I grew up with that. I'd seen that my whole childhood, and I went over to go pick her up, and as I went over to pick her up, leaned over, and her hands are black and her face is black, and she's been dead about 4 days. And I just kind of panic, right? And I run out, and the door locks behind me, and the police, you know, I have to call the police, got to call the paramedics and that, and they're not sure how she died, so they got to call the coroner, and it turns into this big ordeal. And my buddy Bob ended up coming over from AA, and we sat there, and I'm sitting there, and it was a couple hours of them doing this stuff with the coroner. And as I'm sitting there, they got her zipped up in the bag, and they're bringing her out. And as they're bringing her out, this butterfly comes, and it sits on this rose bush sitting right in front of me. My mom had planted these roses, and this is just my experience with it. I think that was my mom's way of telling me that the alcoholic hell was done for her. My mother's first day in Alcoholics Anonymous was Father's Day, 1972. She went to meetings for nearly 25 years and never got sober. Never got sober. I used to say from the podium, she'd gone in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for 25 years. And my sponsor pointed out, she goes, you can't be out of something you've never been in. And my mom was never in Alcoholics Anonymous, but she went to a lot of meetings, you know, and she'd go to meetings and I would hear the things that they would say to her. You know, they would tell her things like, you know, just don't drink no matter what. And I would think to myself, if I could just not drink no matter what's the point of that? You know, what's the point of the book? You know, the book tells me that I'm beyond all human power, I'm beyond all human aid, that I can't just not drink no matter what. You know, I have to have a higher power. I have to have something that is greater than me that can help me through this thing. And not long after that, I went to a speaker meeting, and a guy got up here at the podium, a guy named Johnny H. And he was nothing in common. I have nothing in common with the guy. You know, I mean, he was at that time, he was probably 40 years sober, and ran the yard at San Quentin, and, you know, big time gangster and all that. You know, I'm a little punk from Agora. And but he got up here and he started telling his story, and he got to a part in the story and he goes, if you have a problem with drugs or alcohol, he goes, all you got to do is stop drinking, stop doing the drugs, clean up your life, and you'll be fine. And I'm like, okay, well, I've been hearing that for the last 10 years that I've been going to AA meetings. And he goes, however, if you have the illness of alcoholism and you don't have a spiritual form of recovery as laid out in that book right there, he said, three things will happen to you. You're going to go insane, you're going to go back to drinking, or you're going to wind up killing yourself. And that was where I was. I've been trying to kill myself for the last 6 months. And I ended up going to another meeting, and I had no intention of asking that man to be my sponsor. But it ended up that I was standing right next to the guy. And I looked up at him and I said, Johnny, I need some help. And he says, call me every Monday night, meet me in Bellflower every Monday. He said, call me every day, meet me in Bellflower every Monday night. And he turned around and walked away. And I was kind of waiting for him to give me a hug or say, you know, something. And he didn't. I had no idea where Bellflower was. I was still living in Moor Park. And it took me a long time to get down there that day. A lot of different freeways. And if you'd like to come along sometime, I'll take you on each one of them. But I got down there and I was dressed like I normally dressed in a meeting. You know, I had shorts on, I had flip-flops, I had a t-shirt on, you know, had my hat on backwards. And I walked in there and went over to say hi to Johnny, and he looked at me and he grabbed me by the neck and pulled me behind the coffee pots and he said, kid, this is not a basketball game. I don't ever want to see you dressed like that again in a meeting. And he walked away. And I didn't. You know, I drove how many hours to hear that? I was pissed. I'm like, I'm out. I'm gone. And so I go back out into outside where the meeting is. And apparently I had put my keys down on somebody who had probably been sitting there for 30 years or something in that same seat. And, you know, I don't know. I just think I'm entitled to sit anywhere I want, right? And so I put my keys down. And when I walked back in there, the guy who had been sitting there for a while, my keys were long gone. I had no idea where they went. And everybody, the bell's ringing, and everybody's like, hey, sit down. And I'm like, I'm trying to leave. And so I finally just sat down. There was an empty chair over on the side, and I sat down. And a guy got up to the podium, and what he did, he made Alcoholics Anonymous look so good that I wanted to come back. And that guy was Mark's sponsor. The guy was a good friend of Daryl's, a good friend of Tracy's and Bill's, a guy named Larry Thomas who would talk here on Mark's birthday. And, you know, I get to step into that mode this year, and, you know, thank you for that. But that guy changed my life. He being able to go there, you know, he didn't tell me what to do, same thing. He just showed me what to do. You know, I came back the next week. I had big boy pants on. I had a collared shirt on. You know, I had real shoes. And I got there and I just sat down. And I sat down and just started to watch. And I just started to see what those people do. I started to learn about what it meant to have respect for Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I had no idea. You know, I'm the guy that sits in the back and you know, makes fun of the speakers and talks and, you know, gets up and goes to the bathroom and gets up and gets coffee and does all that kind of stuff. And, you know, Johnny finally wrangled me around one night again, and he goes, kid, he goes, what are you doing? He goes, there might be somebody like your mom sitting here, and because you're so selfish and self-centered that you have to get up or talk or do whatever you're doing, that you're stopping her from hearing the message. You have the ability to kill somebody by your selfishness. You know, and I never thought of that kind of stuff, because all I'm thinking about is myself when I'm here. You know, I'm thinking about what I can get out of Alcoholics Anonymous instead of what I can give. Like I said, I ended up I got married here. I met my wife, who talked here not too long ago, I guess. You know, we've been married 25 years. We've got a daughter who's 21 years old, and just got married. We've got our son who was named Harris. We named him after Johnny. You know, I can tell you, our daughter started going down the wrong way when she was like 13, 14 years old. You know, just driving my wife crazy and just doing all the stuff that, you know, that we do. And I asked Johnny, hey, Johnny, what do we do? You know, what do we do? And he said, he goes, you go up and you ask her and you say, you know what, you can do all those things. You just can't do them in our house. And if you want to continue to do that stuff, you can't live here. And if you can't, if you want to stop, you can stay here and we'll help you. And we went and we talked to her and we said, you know, hey, you're welcome to stay here. You just can't do what you're doing. And she said, no, Dad, that's okay. Go ahead and take, you know, just drop me off. And I got in the car with her that night and went to the park. And she goes, just drop me off here. And I tell you, that was the hardest day of my life, to watch my little girl just get out of the car and walk away. You know, 17 years old, had no idea what was going to happen to her. And I can tell you that the power of God and miracles is the most amazing thing, because it took her a while, but she, you know, being out there and doing what she was doing and ripping and running and all that stuff, she eventually found her way, and she found a God of her understanding. And the miracle that's happened between her and her mom, and the reconciliation of that has been unbelievable. My brother, who was up in San Francisco, called me and he said, "Hey, I'm coming down, or I'm not doing so good. Can you come up and visit?" And I said, "Sure." And it was like a Thursday, and I couldn't get there till Saturday, and I got up to the hospital and they're just pulling the sheet up over his head and his liver's out to here, and you know, and if you think money and property and prestige and all that is going to cure this thing, I can tell you that it won't. My brother had everything. My brother was a CFO of a Fortune 500 company, made boatloads of money, had the wife, the two kids, the cars, the, you know, the big house, the whole thing. And I went over to go clean out his place, and he was renting a little dingy, dirty, small little room in a bad part of Oakland. And I went in there, and I go in, and he's got all of his clothes are in a pile over in the corner. And I asked the lady, I go, where's all of his stuff? And he goes, well, that's it right there. And I go, why, what's... She goes, well, he'd been having esophageal hemorrhages for like a year, and he'd just spit up everything and just throw it into his clothes and just throw it in the corner, and same thing, just hope it'd go away, you know. As I'm cleaning out his stuff, I'm cleaning up, and I, he's got a stack of books, you know, how to get sober without AA, how to stop drinking, you know, and all this stuff. And at the bottom, he had a big book that was on there, and then there was a stack of recovery home chips there. And up in Northern California, they call their meeting directors, they call them where and whens. And there was a where and when at the bottom, and I started looking through it, and there was a bunch of phone numbers in there, and there was a guy's name, Glenn Loyster, who was a longtime sober guy. And I just remember thinking to myself, he was that close. He was that close to hearing the message. You know, the guy had given him his phone number. All he had to do was call it, you know, and talk to him. And my other brother is died not too long ago of pancreatic cancer, and he had been in remission for a while, and everybody thought he was pretty good, we were back visiting, and we went over there, and the doctor came back, and he was having some trouble, and the doctor came over that night, and he told him that, you know, nah, we've done more tests, and this is it. There's nothing more we can do for you. There's no amount of radiation. There's no amount of anything. And to watch the hope drain out of my brother's face, to be told that there was nothing more that could be done, and I'm sitting there watching that, and I'm thinking to myself, how is it what we have, right? That in the face of this terminal illness that we have, that all we have to do is come to a meeting and sponsor a couple guys and give some birthday cakes and pray to a God and do some of these simple things. You know, my brother would have given any amount of money to be able to just do what we do and just sit down in a chair someplace to be able to live another day, you know. Johnny ended up getting sick this last year, and kind of more and more, and ended up passing away not long ago. And then Larry ended up getting sick, and Larry passed away. And it's been a rough deal with a lot of guys in our group, you know, finding different sponsors. I mean, poor Daryl. Daryl's, how many guys in the last 5 years? Probably five different sponsors in the last 5 years with Jeff and Larry. Now we're back to being AA brothers again. We both got Todd L as being our sponsor, and it's a good deal. And you know, and our group at Bellflower is a good, strong group, and it's a lot like this group, like Cameron was saying. You know, it's based on, you know, strong sponsorship, and it's based on, you know, the unity of the group, you know, and the enthusiasm, and that's a lot of what our group is based on as well. And I thought being an alcoholic was the worst thing that could ever happen to me when I first got here. Today I find out it's the best thing that's ever happened to me, because I know exactly what my problem is. It's spelled out right there in that book. And all I've got to do to recover from this illness is to come to places like this with people like you. And I want to thank you for allowing me to be here.